Welcome back to Chasing Dramas. This is a podcast that discusses Chinese culture and history through historical Chinese dramas. We are your hosts, Kathy
and Karen.
Today, we are discussing episode 41 of the Tang Dynasty drama, The Longest Day in Chang'an. If you have any comments or questions, please feel free to reach out to us on Instagram or else email us at karenandkathy@chasingdramas.com. As always, this podcast is in English with proper nouns and certain phrases spoken in Mandarin. We will reference translations from what is provided online, and we will also provide our own. For today's podcast episode, we will start with an episode recap, move on to book differences, and then conclude with history. In the drama, the time approaches 2 a.m.
We return to the banquet hall at the Flower Steeple Tower, or Huaelelou, where the emperor is intent on continuing to humiliate the crown prince. The crown prince is tasked with taking a piece of this magnificent dish that is called Jiangshan, or kingdom, or empire, or country. Upon hearing the name of this dish, the entire room fell to their knees, trembling at what the actions of the crown prince could mean. I find it very interesting what these two officials say on the sidelines. They basically make it very plain what the actions or what the crown prince could do. If the crown prince does take a piece of the dish, then it means that he actually wants to usurp his father's position or take his kingdom, aka Jiangshan. Meanwhile, if the crown prince does not take the dish, it is a refusal from a direct order of the emperor. Both actions could mean severe consequences to the crown prince. As the foreign diplomat says, if this happened in his country, the crown prince would basically have no choice but to stage a coup. Can you imagine if your father put you in that position? The crown prince kneels and says he doesn't feel well and recuses himself from the room. That is his only way to save himself from escalating in this situation, but also from further humiliation. He doesn't give anyone a second chance to even say no, he can't go. He just says, I don't feel well and I'm leaving, and just gets up and leave. The crown prince storms out of the banquet hall, screaming for servants to clear a path for him. The crown prince is basically at his wit's end, and it is understandable why he's so upset.
Back at the banquet hall, an epic showdown begins. The right chancellor takes this opportunity to chime about how poorly the crown prince is behaving, only for director He to cut him off. And before the emperor can make a potentially violent order to General Guo in retrieving the crown prince, director He loudly proclaims that he also has a piece of the empire dish and promptly grabs a piece of meat or a pink-looking thing from the dish. From here, Director He begins his monologue that admonishes the emperor for his unfair treatment towards the crown prince. Director He finally speaks his true feelings about how the emperor is being so focused on preventing the crown prince and any other prince from amassing any power that he is not seeing the bigger threats to the empire. Listen here that in much of the episode, when Director He is confronting the emperor, he doesn't call the emperor by his title of Shengren, but by a very familiar name of Silang, or just the fourth son. Emperor Li Longzi was the fourth son to his father and growing up was referred to as Li Silang. Director He here is directly appealing to the emperor to remember a time when the emperor was still diligent about running the empire, and Director He is forcing the emperor to recognize the fact that he is probably also only one of a handful of people living who can still have the right to call the emperor as Silang.
Well, this is problematic because the only other person we've heard call the emperor Silang in this drama is Yan Yuhuan, the consort or the concubine. Not a great mix. Surprisingly to this tirade from Director He, the emperor says, I'm sorry. But he's sorry for not giving a piece of the dish to Director He first. The two then get into an argument about the new calendar convention. Director He cuts off the emperor in recounting how during the Jiu Li, or the old calendar, the emperor enacted many great policies to curb corruption and outlandish extravagance. There were many policies that greatly helped the Tang and helped replenish its treasury and food stores. It was a peaceful time for the people. The emperor screams that Tianbao, the new calendar convention, will be even better. Director He agrees that yes, it will be better without the right chancellor. And then he brings out a knife and tries to stab the right chancellor right then and there. Unfortunately, this assassination attempt fails. The right chancellor was wearing armor that saved his life. And he doesn't miss an opportunity to pin this on the crown prince. And this time, Director He even says to the emperor he should just kill the crown prince. That way, Taizi, or the crown prince, won't see the fall of the Tang Empire. The emperor, on his throne, rebukes the claims that his empire is withering, but Director He comes back even more strongly. The emperor was a good emperor in the past, but not anymore, especially because the emperor gives so much power to the right chancellor. I am really frustrated when, in response to Director He crying out for the right chancellor's death, the emperor says whether or not does Director He actually want the right chancellor dead or the emperor. I am totally with Director He here. Like, come on. How can the emperor not see all the holes and issues plaguing his empire and only cares about whether or not somebody wants him dead? Director He cries that he wants the 25-year-old emperor back. The emperor cannot be tired, cannot shirk responsibility, cannot be overly confident. He must continue to push to be better. The emperor is responsible for the empire alone. And right now, from Director He's point of view, the emperor is trying to push off his responsibility as emperor.
Well, when the emperor stands up at these words, he turns to the court officials next to Director He. On one side is the right chancellor and his group. The other side is the left chancellor. The emperor asks all of them if they also believe what Director He said. The right chancellor and company turn to look away. The left chancellor, who is more allied with the crown prince, leads his group of men to kneel with Director He. This means they agree. Interestingly, in response to all of this later on in the episode, the emperor is able to clearly state that he doesn't understand why his son needs to be the next emperor, because they have grown up coddled as princes. They never experienced the life of a normal person, let alone even leave the city of Chang'an. How could one of them rule properly? That is too dangerous. The emperor instead must rely on his ministers to help him run the empire. This touches all of the ministers in the room, even Director He. The emperor speaks to a number of kneeling ministers and says that they are his soldiers. Having them stand in front of him, the emperor feels safer. This emperor is able to proclaim that the longevity of a dynasty isn't on a single emperor or even a last name. It is by his ministers and court officials. The emperor then asks General Guo to take off his golden robes, which freaks everyone out. But on his throne, the emperor proclaims that after today, he will no longer focus on political or government matters at all. He will rely on everyone in the room. I would consider this episode a prophetic one, mainly because we, as the audience, have the benefit of seeing how history played out. Everything so far that Director He and the Crown Prince state essentially comes true, while the statements from the Emperor do not turn in his favor. So right now, I'm going to mix a little bit about the episode and history together. I want to dissect many of the statements one by one because as we head to the end of the drama, this drama continuously presents the audience a sense of foreboding. And I interpret this as because we know how history played out. So let's start with a couple of examples. Earlier on, Director He bluntly informs the Emperor that he has turned away from his duties as emperor. The Tang dynasty will begin to wane during his reign. This is true. The emperor turns to the earthly pleasures with his noble consort Yang and shuns politics and government, leaving an opening for the devastating An Lushan Rebellion in 755, which lasts for 8 years. The Tang dynasty never recovers from this and scrapes by another 100 years before the dynasty crumbles. Director Hua then shouts for the emperor to kill the right chancellor because he is a leech on the empire. The emperor basically ignores Director Hua's assassination attempt and makes no action against the right chancellor. In history, the right chancellor's legacy is one of corruption, bribery, and control, and allowed An Lushan's faction to gain power, leading to the An Lushan Rebellion. He is that leech that the emperor currently just disregards. Now, moving to an example from the Crown Prince. The Crown Prince, in his carriage, ponders how history will remember his father, the once great and brilliant Sheng Ren. The Tang Empire also now has enemies lurking everywhere. At least to me, this is a true statement of the fact that we judge Emperor Tang Xuanzong in many ways. In history, we do remember him for the grandeur of the Tang Dynasty in his early years. For example, the Kaiyuan era. But unfortunately, much is overshadowed by his romance with noble consort Yang and the An Lushan Rebellion, to a point where there is little discourse about his earlier accomplishments. There are many poems about his relationship to noble consort Yang, and of course, the aftermath of the An Lushan Rebellion. He, though, also is known mainly as the emperor who began the decline of the Tang Dynasty. Meanwhile, on the flip side, the emperor argues that the new Tianbao era, which we are now in, will be better than the last era. Unfortunately, that is just not the case because the Tianbao era directly leads into the An Lushan Rebellion and the sacking of Chang'an. The emperor then argues why it is that his sons must become the greatest man in the empire and must rule. It's his members of court who are the ones who will protect his empire, not his sons. So this statement, while correct in history, was what also allowed for men to amass individual power and local militias to such a point that different governors could rebel and did rebel during the An Lushan Rebellion. So again, this was not a correct statement or, I guess, a correct desire from the emperor. And lastly, the emperor then asks to the whole group in there, what is the emperor? He is the son of heaven. He is a dragon. He is a deity. He is there for the people to behave as a god. And from now on, he will not manage the day-to-day aspects of the empire. In history, he basically did do just that. He retreated. And I mean, I don't need to restate any further, but again, the empire began its downward trajectory as the emperor chose not to rule, but just become a figurehead. And this is why, as we see from the different various points, why I say this is a prophetic episode. I don't think viewers who don't know the history realize how heavy this episode was for me. As I was watching, every statement from Director He and the Crown Prince served as kind of like a blow to me because I was hoping that the emperor would change. But alas, history is history, and no matter how, I would say, meta right now the characters are, we can't change history. Well, that was really the conversation or the scene with the emperor and his court. What has been going on with Zhang Xiaojing? Simply put, he and Xiao Gui have reconnected, and Xiao Gui is still on his path of destruction. He wants to speak to the emperor to understand exactly why he ordered what he did to cause the death of so many of his brothers. It turns out, and this is more fleshed out in the book, the whole reason why Xiao Gui is even here is because he heard of the tragedy that befell Zhang Xiaojing and Wen Wuji. Xiaogui thought that the two would have a great life in Chang'an, but in the end, Zhang Xiaojing is just seen as an ant. Xiaogui is here to avenge his brothers and wants this rampage to happen because he is angry that the system, that is the Tang Emperor, failed them. Xiaogui is rightly upset at hearing that Wen Ran died, but that does not deter him from his path. On the contrary, I feel like he's even more energized by it. Xiaogui gently folds up the flag of the 8th Squad and is ready to head out. Zhang Xiaojing offers to stay in the tower to ensure that the contraptions work. Yu Chang also offers to stay to ensure that the mechanisms are also working and basically make sure that Zhang Xiaojing does what he said he would do. Xiaogui and Yu Chang have kind of like a heartwarming goodbye because Xiaogui knows that this will be the last time he sees her. But I'm kind of like, Yu Chang, you haven't been the greatest character, so I'm not all that sad to see them depart ways. Xiaogui and his men make their way to the Flower Steeple Tower and easily break through the security measures. In the meantime, Yu Chang was correct in believing that Zhang Xiaojing would betray them. He's indeed trying to stop the tower from blowing up. The two end up in a furious fight with Yu Chang losing an arm in that process, and that was quite brutal. Meanwhile, Li Bi regains consciousness. He wasn't actually killed by Zhang Xiaojing in the last episode, but only knocked unconscious and is able to escape. He runs to find the Crown Prince, who had stormed away from the banquet hall. The Crown Prince is upset to hear about the impending danger and is at first a little hesitant on what his next steps are, but still decides to try to save the Emperor. After all, he says, the Emperor is his father. The Crown Prince is certainly a better man than his father at this point, and also foreshadows what the Crown Prince does for his father during the An Lushan Rebellion. And with that, that brings us to the end of the episode. Let's now turn to history. When Li Bi escapes to find the Crown Prince, he urges the Crown Prince to save Zhang Xiaojing. Li Bi rattles off a series of numbers, and in Chinese they are 3, 11, 8, 4, 18. And he informs the Crown Prince that these mean 不退, or never retreat. So in English, they are 3, 11, 8, 4, 5, and 18. These numbers come from Tang Yun, or the Chinese Rhyme Dictionary of the Tang Dynasty. This was compiled by Sun Mian. The Tang Yun, or the Tang Dynasty Rhyme Dictionary, was based off of a Sui Dynasty Rhyme Dictionary called Qie Yun, which was published in 601. These dictionaries served as a guide to proper reading of classical texts and to indicate the pronunciation of Chinese characters. Tang Yun was roughly compiled in 732 as an additional version of Qie Yun. The complete originals have long been lost, but we do know that the whole dictionary had 5 volumes, and some of the scripts of those 5 volumes have survived today. The combination of 3, 11, 8, 4, 5, and 18 has the first 3 indicating the sound or pronunciation of tui, with the second triplet of numbers indicating the sound of bu. You combine that together and we get tui bu, but also bu tui. So how did Li Bi get these numbers? Well, Zhang Xiaojing told him in the previous episode, right when Zhang Xiaojing was about to kill Li Bi, he tells Li Bi a couple of items to turn back to Taoism and go pray to the San Qing Shi Yao, play with the Ba Gua, climb the Si Shan Wu Yue, and then meet Zhang Xiaojing at Shi Ba Cheng Di Yu. So you hear that in Chinese, it's San Qing Shi Yao Ba Gua Si Shan Wu Yue Shi Ba Cheng Di Yu. So you have all of those 6 as a code. The three Sunseeing are the three pure ones from Taoism. We've talked about them a little bit before in episode 36. For the Shi Yao, they are another set of lesser gods. Then the Bagua equals the eight trigrams. Then we have the four mountains and five peaks, with the five peaks being Taishan, Huashan, Songshan, Hengshan, and another Hengshan. And then we have Shibaseng Diyu, which is the 18th level of hell. This code makes complete sense to the audience in front of Xiao Gui in the last episode, because it totally went over my head in the last episode. But thankfully here, Li Bi deciphered what Zhang Xiaojing wanted him to learn or know in this episode. I must say, this was a very clever code from Zhang Xiaojing. And thankfully, again, Li Bi was willing and smart enough to be able to decipher it. All right, lastly, let's turn to the emperor. He quotes heavily from Dao De Jing this episode in his response to Director He's accusations. In the beginning, he gives this statement. 天地之所以能长且久者,以其不自生,故能长生. Or the translation is as such. Heaven and earth last forever. Why do heaven and earth last forever? It is because their actions aren't for themselves, so ever living. We discussed this phrase back in episode 35, so I won't analyze it here, and I took that translation from online. The emperor, though, continues to quote the rest of the paragraph from Dao De Jing with what we have here. 是以圣人后其身而身先,外其身而身存, 非以其无私邪,故能成其私. I'll start with a reference to a translation that I found online. The sage stays behind, thus he is ahead. He is detached, thus at one with all. Through selfless action, he attains fulfillment. Here's my take. The sage does not retreat, but leads. He detaches himself and protects himself. Isn't it because he is selfless that he becomes fulfilled? So, in this episode, the emperor quotes from Taoism, specifically the last bit that I just translated, because he wants to emulate a Taoist sage and attain fulfillment, saying that he will retreat because he is fulfilled. Good for him. But he is the emperor, and he cannot just wipe his hands and walk away. He, I believe, has the responsibility to his people and lead the charge. He is an emperor. He is not a Taoist sage. So I do not agree with his statements here. I don't believe the emperor here is selfless because he's giving power to others. He is selfish, in my mind, because he's walking away. As you can probably tell, I really didn't like the emperor this episode. He's playing political games with everyone in the room, especially his son, the crown prince, and is willingly blind to the leeches in his empire. The emperor was able to get his court all misty-eyed, but I'm not buying it. We'll see if the emperor gets his comeuppance in subsequent episodes, but as of this current episode, I am just going to be very disappointed at the fact that he essentially said, I'm done with my role and job as emperor. I'm just going to sit back and enjoy. And that closes out our discussion of episode 41 of The Longest Day in Chang'an. The music for this episode is Qingping Yue, played by Karen, with sheet music by Cui Jianghui. If you're looking for sites to watch dramas and you're in the U.S., head over to our sponsor, Jubao TV. That's J-U-B-A-O TV. It's a free service that has a selection of Chinese dramas and movies to watch. Once again, thank you all so much for listening, and we will catch you in the next podcast episode.